Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are plunging into a moment in sports history that really has everything. Drama, incredible endurance, amazing talent, and a story of integrity that, you know, still resonates today. We're looking at a stack of sources focused on just one event, the 1925 U.S. Open Golf Championship.
That's right. We've pulled from articles, historical accounts, notes, basically trying to unpack this specific championship. And our mission really is to go beyond just who won. We want to explore the characters involved, the pretty brutal setting, the rules back then, and especially that one moment of sportsmanship that became, well, legendary.
Yeah, think of this as your shortcut, maybe, to getting truly informed about a championship that holds a really unique place in golf history. So let's dive in.
Okay, let's set the scene. The 1925 U.S. Open happened at Worcester Country Club. That's in Worcester, Massachusetts. It was over 3 days, June 3rd to the 5th.
Right.
The course itself was a Donald Ross design, pretty challenging. For the championship, it played at 6,430 yards, par 71.
And Worcester Country Club, it wasn't just notable for this one championship, right? It has a pretty significant history attached to it.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It really does. What's fascinating is Worcester's unique place. It had already hosted the first ever U.S. Open qualifier just the year before, in 1924.
Okay.
Then, just 2 years after this 25 Open, it was the site for the very first Ryder Cup matches. That was 1927.
Wow.
And then later, much later, they added the U.S. Women's Open in 1960.
So wait, for a long time, it was actually the only club to have hosted the Men's U.S. Open, the Women's U.S. Open, and the Ryder Cup. That's quite something.
Yeah, a remarkable distinction, a serious pedigree that I think stood for over 50 years. And the course itself had its own quirks, too. Like five par three holes, which was kind of unusual for the time and a really tough, especially around that famous 11th hole we'll probably talk about.
Speaking of challenges, the conditions, they sound like something else entirely, almost like a crucible.
They were absolutely brutal, especially those first 2 days of regulation play.
Yeah.
The temperatures soaring above 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oof.
Yeah. You had players out there for hours, wide-brimmed hats, just trying to get some relief from that heat.
And they weren't just playing 18 holes a day in that kind of heat, were they?
No. And that's a really key point here. This was actually the last time the U.S. Open scheduled all 72 holes of regulation play over just 2 days.
36 holes a day.
36 holes on Wednesday, 36 on Thursday. I mean, just imagine trying to tackle that course in over 100-degree heat.
The physical toll must have been just immense. I think I read somewhere Bobby Jones lost a significant amount of weight.
Yeah, he reportedly lost 12 pounds over the 3 days, and that includes the playoff day. This grueling format, and specifically how tough the 25 event was, it's widely seen as the thing that pushed the USGA to change the format.
Oh, okay.
Starting in 1926, they moved to 3 days, and then eventually it evolved into the four-day event we know now.
So this championship didn't just deliver drama. It actually changed the structure of future U.S. Open.
It absolutely did. It really highlighted the extreme demands on the players and, you know, forced a necessary change.
All right. Let's turn to the main players here, the central figures in this story, Willie McFarlane and Bobby Jones. Their contrast, it just adds such a fascinating layer to the whole thing.
It really does. So on one side, you've got William McFarlane, known as Willie. He was a seasoned pro, born in Scotland, Aberdeen, actually, about 35 or 36 years old and 25. Mm-hmm. He was part of that wave of talented Scots who came over to the U.S., became leading club professionals. He was the pro at Oak Ridge Golf Club in New York.
And he wasn't exactly new to winning, right? He already had some victories on what was then the sort of burgeoning pro tour.
Exactly, yeah. He was an established player, had several tour wins already, some decent finishes in majors too, like a T8 in the 1920 U.S. Open. So he represented that, you know, dedicated, skillful professional, really striving for the big one, a major title.
And then Bobby Jones.
The phenomenal.
Yeah.
The young amateur from Atlanta, still only in his early 20s. But by 1925, I mean, he was already a household name, consistently beating the top pros, even though he kept his amateur status.
He'd already won the U.S. Open back in 23 and the U.S. amateur in 24. So his incredible run of dominance was clearly underway.
Oh, yeah. That period from 23 to 30.
Yeah.
It's arguably the most dominant stretch anyone's ever had in golf. And Jones wasn't just a golfer, which is also amazing. He was pursuing multiple degrees at the same time. Georgia Tech, Harvard, Emory.
Right, the scholar-athlete thing.
The true icon in that sense.
So you've got this contrast, the the experienced pro working his way up against this almost mythical amateur legend who's balancing top-level sport and academics. Mm. That dynamic really sets the stage perfectly, doesn't it?
It adds such a rich texture to the competition, absolutely. You know, the respected pro looking for his peak moment versus the transcendent amateur who sort of embodied this pure ideal of the game.
Okay, let's get into the golf itself. The 72 holes that led them to that tie. Day one, Wednesday, June 3rd, 36 holes in that killer heat.
Right. So the first round, Francis Wu met the hero from 1913. Remember, he shot his superb 70. Jones actually had a much higher score than people expected, a 77. While McFarlane came in with a 74.
And it was during that opening round, wasn't it? Specifically on the 11th hole that we get the moment this championship might be most remembered for, kind of regardless of who eventually won.
This is it. This is where the story shifts from just a competition to, well, legend territory. Bobby Jones's ball was in the deep rough on the 11th. As he got ready to hit, just as he addressed the ball with his club, he felt, or perceived, a tiny movement. He said the ball moved a smidge.
A smidge. But crucially, nobody else saw anything. Not his playing partner's officials.
Nobody. Critically, no one else saw it. Not his caddy, not his playing partners, Leo Deagle and Charles Hoffner, not the officials nearby, not the spectators watching closely.
Yeah.
So when he reported it, the officials, well, they couldn't verify it themselves, so they basically deferred to his judgment.
And he just insisted on taking the penalty stroke?
Absolutely. Didn't hesitate. Unwavering. He called a one-stroke penalty on himself under the rules at the time. And later, when people were praising him for his integrity, you know, calling a penalty nobody else saw, he had that famous reply.
The bank robbing line.
Exactly. You may as well praise me for not robbing a bank. There is only one way to play the game.
That line is just, it's so powerful. It says so much about his character, his view of golf.
It really does. And here's the incredible, almost cruel twist of fate. That single stroke he insisted on taking back in the first round.
Yeah.
That's the exact margin that created the tie after 72 holes. It forced the playoff that he eventually lost.
Wow. So the act of integrity literally cost him the chance to win the championship outright in regulation. That's staggering.
It's truly staggering. And it just shows how deeply that principle was ingrained in him.
Yeah.
There's actually a plaque at Worcester Country Club now near the 11th tee commemorating it. Calls it a defining moment in the game of golf.
Incredible. Okay, so back to that grueling first day. After Jones's moment on 11, they still had another 18 holes to play in the afternoon heat. How did the leaderboard look after day one?
Well, McFarlane had an absolutely phenomenal second round. Shot a 67. That was a new U.S. Open single round record at the time.
A record 67.
Yep. That brilliant round shot out the leaderboard. He finished day one at 141, tied for the lead with Leo Deagle. Jones, meanwhile, recovered really well from that opening 77. He shot a 70 in the afternoon, finishing the day at 147. Still in it, but back a bit.
Okay, so moving into day two, Thursday, June 4th, another 36-hole marathon. How did the leaders hold up?
In the morning, the third round, McFarlane shot a steady 72. That kept him in the lead by one stroke at 213 total. Jones had another strong round, a 70, that moved him up to 217, tied for fourth, definitely in contention. Johnny Farrell was second at 214.
And then the final round, R4, that afternoon, everything on the line.
Yeah, the pressure round. McFarlane actually struggled a bit here. He carded a 78, which brought his 72-hole total to 291. Jones, meanwhile, shot a 74, and that also brought his total to 291.
Ah.
Pied.
So there it is. The margin, after 72 holes of incredibly tough golf, was indeed that single stroke Jones added to his score back on day one.
Precisely. If he hadn't called that penalty on himself, his score would have been 290. He would have won the championship outright by one shot, no playoff needed.
Unbelievable. And McFarlane, didn't he have his own little bit of magic or maybe luck on the very last hole of regulation just to get into that tie?
Yes, that's another key detail. On the 72nd hole, the 18th, McFarlane's approach putt stopped short and rolled right into an old ball mark on the green.
Oh, no. And you couldn't repair those then?
Nope. Rules were different. You couldn't repair ball marks back then, so it could have been a disaster. But McFarlane, totally unfazed, just calmly took out a mid-iron and chipped the ball straight into the hole from the ball mark for par.
With a mid-iron. From a ball mark.
Yeah. That clutch chip saved his par, secured his 291 total, and forced the tie with Jones. Incredible nerve.
So after two brutal 36-hole days, scorching heat, unbelievable moments, McFarlane and Jones are tied at 291. Farrell and Ouimet just one shot back at 292. And just to remind everyone about the context, McFarlane, the pro, is playing for the $500 winner's purse. Jones, the amateur, is playing purely for glory and the trophy. no prize money.
Exactly. That difference was so clear back then, really defined that whole amateur ideal versus the professional grind.
Okay, so now the playoff. And this wasn't like a modern sudden death thing, right? It wasn't even just 18 holes.
No, this is where the story gets truly extraordinary, almost beyond belief. USGA rules at the time. They mandated an 18-hole playoff the next day. So on Friday, June 5th, McFarlane and Jones go head-to-head again for another 18 holes. And after those 18, they were still tied. Both shot 75. They could be separated.
So what did the rules say then?
No sudden death yet.
Yeah.
The 1925 rules dictated another full 18-hole playoff.
You're kidding.
Nope. To be played immediately that same afternoon.
Wait, wait. So after playing 36 holes on Wednesday in 100-plus degrees, 36 holes on Thursday in 100-plus degrees, they play 18 holes Friday morning tie, and then have to play another 18 holes Friday afternoon.
That's exactly right.
That is a staggering 108 holes of competitive golf in just 3 days. Most of it under that extreme heat.
It's almost unthinkable today. An unbelievable test of endurance, physical and mental. And in that decisive second 18-hole playoff that afternoon, it actually looked for a while like Jones was finally going to pull away.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he built up a commanding 4-stroke lead after the first 9 holes.
4 strokes up with 9 to play in the second playoff? That must have felt like it was over for McFarlane.
You'd think so. Many probably did. But the back 9 saw just a dramatic, resilient comeback from McFarlane. He played those final 9 holes in an estimated 33 strokes. That's 3 under par. Made key birdies on the 10th and 13th holes.
And how did Jones respond to that pressure, McFarlane coming back at him?
Jones faltered just slightly.
Yep.
He bogeyed the 13th hole, the exact same hole McFarlane birdied. And just like that, poof, that 4-stroke lead, gone. The match was all square heading towards the final few holes.
Wow. The tension on the 108th tee of the tournament must have been just unimaginable.
Absolutely palpable. So on the final hole, the 18th again, McFarlane played it safe, got his ball onto the green. Jones, maybe feeling the fatigue, maybe the pressure, maybe both, found himself in a greenside bunker.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. He couldn't get up and down from there, carded a bogey.
Leaving McFarlane.
Leaving McFarlane on the green with 2 putts for par and the championship.
Yeah.
And he coolly rolled them both in. 2 putts for par. McFarlane shot 72 in that second playoff. Jones shot 73. McFarlane wins by 1 stroke.
What an ending. A comeback from 4 down on the back 9 of the second playoff after playing 107 holes already.
It was just an incredible testament to McFarlane's grit, his skill under pressure, his resilience, especially doing it against a legend like Jones.
Yeah.
In those conditions, he truly earned it.
So for Willie McFarlane, this was it, the defining moment of his career, really.
Oh, absolutely, the pinnacle. His first major championship victory and his only major win, as it turned out. But to get it by beating Bobby Jones, the dominant force of the era, in that kind of exhausting, unprecedented playoff, I mean, that's a monumental achievement. Plus, he was the first Scot to win the U.S. Open since Alex Smith way back in 1910.
And this win, it wasn't just a fluke, right? It was part of a very solid, respectable career.
No, not at all. He had a very good career. Won 20 other events on the PGA Tour, including multiple Metropolitan Opens, Westchester Opens. He was a top-tier pro for many years.
And that story about paying his caddy, that's such a great little detail from the time.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Apparently, McFarlane initially offered the caddy $10 per round. Standard rate, maybe? But the caddy, feeling confident, negotiated for half of the winner's prize money. If McFarlane won, that's $250 out of the $500 purse, but nothing if he lost.
High stakes for the caddy.
Yeah. And after the win, McFarlane paid him his $250 share. Reportedly, he delivered it to the caddy's home in $55 bills, because the caddy was worried about carrying that much cash around. Just a fun glimpse into the times.
That's a great anecdote. It feels like sometimes McFarlane's incredible win, that record 67, the playoff comeback, it kind of gets overshadowed by the huge legend of Bobby Jones and that famous integrity moment. But McFarlane was clearly a supremely worthy champion who absolutely earned that trophy.
No question about it. His play was phenomenal. That 67 was a record. And his performance in that marathon playoff was just masterful.
And then there's Bobby Jones. It's almost a paradox, isn't it? But losing this championship, especially the way he did, seems to have somehow enhanced his legend, maybe even more than winning would have.
I think you're right. It really did. I mean, Jones's overall record during his peak, that 23-30 stretch, is just mind-boggling. 13 majors in only 21 tries, including the Grand Slam in 1930.
Unprecedented.
Totally. And he stayed an amateur through it all. Retired at just 28, right at the absolute peak of his game.
And that amateur status, it just meant something profoundly different back in the 1920s, didn't it?
Completely different world. The distinction was really strict, really meaningful. Amateurs did not take prize money. Jones played for the trophy, for the honor, for the love of the game, you know. At this 25 Open, while McFarlane got the $500 first prize, the official runner-up prize was $300. Jones finished tied for second, but received $0.
And Francis Ouimet, also an amateur, finished fourth and also got nothing.
Exactly. This whole amateur ideal, it really resonated powerfully with the public back then.
It seemed to elevate him, didn't it? Beyond just being a great sportsman to being this kind of heroic figure.
I think so. His unbelievable skill, combined with his commitment to that amateur code, and then, crucially, that undeniable moment of integrity on the 11th hole in 25, it just solidified his image.
Mm-hmm.
So the loss in 25, because of how it happened, became this incredibly powerful symbol of sportsmanship over winning at all costs.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even more impactful for his legacy than another trophy would have been.
And it's why the USGA's highest honor today, the one recognizing character and integrity in golf, is called the Bob Jones Award.
It's a direct line, absolutely.
Yeah.
Straight back to that moment on the 11th green and the principles he stood for his whole career.
So stepping back now, looking at the bigger picture,
What
else does the 1925 U.S. Open tell us about the golf world of that specific era?
Well, it highlights several really defining things about golf's golden age, as they call it. First, the brutal weather and that punishing format. They weren't just random events. They showed the raw physical demands of the game before modern conditioning, modern scheduling. And like we said, it directly led to fundamental changes in how the Open was run.
Right. And the prize money structure, it just shows how different the financial world was for pros compared to today. $500 for winning the U.S. Open.
Yeah, a different universe. And how the championship was received at the time is also telling. The New York Times calling it easily the greatest Open championship of them all. That gives you a sense of the excitement it generated.
It wasn't just some niche sports event. It was making international news, even if some papers down in Tasmania apparently called him Jokes instead of Jones.
Jokes. But they knew he'd been beaten by McFarlane. But another thing that really stands out, looking back, is the incredible concentration of talent right there at the top of the leaderboard.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Okay, look at the top finishers in 1925. You had McFarlane winning, Jones tied second, Johnny Farrell also tied second, Francis Ouimet fourth. Then tied for fifth were Walter Hagen and Gene Sarazen.
That's a who's who of golf legends right there.
Exactly. McFarlane, Jones, Farrell, Ouimet, Hagen, Sarazen. Every single one of those guys eventually won the U.S. Open at some point in their careers.
All six of them.
All six. That is an incredibly strong leaderboard. It really underlines the quality of play at the very top during that era.
And it really puts McFarlane's victory into perspective, doesn't it? Beating that field under those conditions in that playoff.
Absolutely. Gives you a fantastic snapshot of the major championship scene in the 1920s. You have the U.S. Open, the Open Championship, the British Open, the PGA Championship just for pros, and then the U.S. and British amateurs, which were huge deals for players like Jones.
So wrapping up our reflections here, the 1925 U.S. Open was clearly way more than just a score on a leaderboard.
Oh, absolutely. It was this remarkable mix of endurance, character, incredible high-stakes drama, and real historical significance. It marked the absolute peak for Willie McFarlane, showcased his skill, his resilience, from that record-breaking 67 to the amazing playoff comeback.
And for Bobby Jones, yeah, it was a competitive loss, but it gave us one of the most compelling examples ever of his unwavering integrity. It sort of solidified his status as the amateur ideal and became this enduring symbol of sportsmanship, really, in all of sport, not just golf.
And beyond the players, it directly influenced how the championship was run going forward. It cemented Worcester Country Club's important place in golf history, and it just offers this really clear window into the values and the dynamics of golf's golden age.
So what does this all mean for us looking back? I think the story of the 1925 U.S. Open really reminds us that sometimes how you play the game, you know, the character you show when you're under intense pressure, that can resonate just as powerfully, maybe even more so, than the final score on the card.
Yeah, it makes you think, doesn't it? About what we truly value in sports, in competition, and in the people who compete. Is it just about the win? Or is it also about the way you go about trying to achieve it?
What stands out most to you from this look back at such an epic championship? Well, thanks everyone for joining us for this deep dive into the 1925 U.S. Open. We really hope it's given you some insights into a championship that, it truly had it all.